set free.
Favorite game in all of synthesis is Guess That Synth.
I don't think that was the synth. I just thought it sounded awesome.
Bitch, that was the fucking synth that had.
Play it again.
Play it on your speaker so you can hear it though, because I want you to like to know I'm right. So hear it. Look it up. Arp Selena.
It sounds really cool, but I don't think that's the same fucking thing.
Do it again. Listen,
are you listening? Can you hear it?
I can hear you. Go. I think that's an ARP, Selena. I really just want to know that I'm right. Can you tell me what the name is of this song? It's
called Modern Fears.
Modern Fears.
Electric Youth.
Oh my goodness. All right. I'm Stephanie Franciotti and this is Synth Freak. I'm joined once again by the man with an attic full of synthesizers. Ladies and gentlemen, Alex Goldman.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here once again. I do, in fact, have an attic full of synthesizers. And we were just seconds before arguing about what synthesizer appears on a song. So, like, real on brand.
I was right. I think.
Okay.
I mean, okay. We have a podcast about synthesizers. Couldn't we just, like, ask?
I mean, it feels like it could be any polysynth with the cutoff, with, like, the frequency turned down. It just,
that's an ARP Selena. It's a string synth.
All you have to do is you turn the attack up, you turn the fucking frequency down, you make one a square, one a saw. That's my guess. All right. Okay. So who are you talking to in this episode?
So this week I talked to one of my all-time favorite synth freaks, Paul Miller of Slugbug.
You introduced me to his music while you were working on this. I have to say that it is, the style of music that he plays is probably like what I think of as the most formative synth music for me. Like there were bands when I was growing up that where it was like this natural bridge between like punk and like stuff that was very chaotic and loud and guitar-y. Mm-hmm. And music with synthesizers that might have like a bit more sort of texture to the music, and like he is deep in that cut, and so it really hit like a pleasure center in my brain to hear his music.
Yeah, dude, I mean it's like the weirdest electronic punk new wave. It's like classical in some ways. Like he just sounds like he must have had classical music training, even though from talking to him he claims like he has none of that background, but from listening to it I'm like, that cannot be the case at all.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it also, I mean, it's like pop music, but it's so much more subtly complex than one would imagine pop music to sound.
It's like a blown out Zolo version of Bach or something.
Yeah, it just made me jealous to listen to.
It made me jealous. It sounds, you guys kind of sound similar.
I think I'm like the baby version of him. He's running and I'm crawling. Someday. Someday. Well, I'm what, 42? I have roughly 40 years to go.
Yeah, you're halfway there.
Right. I'm halfway to death. My last action will be the perfect chord, and then I'm done.
It's like a seventh chord. So I met Paul officially many years ago, actually, when he fixed my Prophet 600 after my cat pissed on it, which is not at all the way that I would have liked to meet somebody that I was like, I like admired musically, but that is how that happened.
Did you keep the cat?
I kept my cat.
I'm just
no, straight to the electric chair.
I don't know. Crazier things have happened.
That was like such a learning experience for me though, because I mean, not like about the cat and peeing on the synth, but what Paul did to like take care of business was he opened up my Prophet, took it in the back and fucking hosed it down. And I was just like, oh my God, what is this guy doing? And apparently that's something that you can do, and it's all good and fine. You can just like fucking hose that shit down and it's all good.
You know, I've learned that a lot of electronic equipment can get super wet as long as it's not turned on. And once you, yeah. and until you, I have a friend, this is a true story. I've never been angrier about anything in my life.
Oh no.
No, I'm just angry with out of jealousy. This okay. is just crazy. My friend, Michael Troutman, brilliant musician, total sweetheart, was living in Brooklyn, was walking home one night, found a cat octave leaning up against a tree in a rainstorm. Oh. He took it home and let it dry out. It played perfect. Perfect.
That's really strange.
Isn't that weird?
Why? What? Was? Do you think he accidentally stole it? It couldn't have been Michael, like, getting taken out with a trap.
There are a lot of things that one could say about Michael Troutman, but he's not a thief.
No, but
he's
an just accidental, a sweet boy. An accidental listen, stealing.
Okay, listen. If you leave a fucking synthesizer under a tree in a rainstorm in Brooklyn, that's fair game. That's on you.
It's your own fault. So yeah, like what were we talking about? Yeah, cat peed on my synthesizer. Paul fixed it. It was horrifying for me to have forgotten that experience and then have him bring it up in that interview. But whatever. Paul is an incredible musician and repair person. He's like one of the best synth technicians I've ever known. He can pretty much fix anything ever. Like he fixes cars, he fixes electronics, he fixes anything that is broken. It's fucking bonkers. He's like MacGyver, except like if MacGyver applied all of his knowledge and skill to arcane electronics and things that aren't. What did MacGyver do? Like government spy job or whatever?
What did MacGyver do? I feel like Richard Dean Anderson, blah, blah, blah. In both portrayals, he's a genius level intellect, blah, 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 so on and so forth. He's nonviolent. He eschews guns. He works for the fictional Phoenix Foundation.
So what is that, a nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit think tank and government contractor that employs Peter Thornton and MacGyver.
I used to love MacGyver. Like that was like my first love was MacGyver.
I always fucking hated it. Like if I had a choice between that and Airwolf, I'd always go with Airwolf.
What is Airwolf?
Airwolf was a show about a helicopter with Ernest Borgnine in it. Airwolf was the helicopter. Ernest Borgnine, I think, was the pilot.
Was the helicopter like the main character? Like a Herbie, like a Herbie Love Bug situation?
No. No, the
fully loaded.
The helicopter isn't like, I love blowing up Russians.
That's the fully loaded part. But let me round it out with some stuff about Paul. So he's obviously a hilarious genius. I was looking at his SoundCloud and he describes himself as a nervous man making dork sound nuggets.
Sounds right.
Yeah, that's like my favorite genre of person. Let's spin it around and break it off.
Yeah,
this episode.
I'm excited to listen.
It's slug bug time.
Paul D. Miller. I am authorized service personnel by whom I couldn't tell you. It just kind of happened.
What are you authorized to do?
Whatever is required to get the thing down the road and get the record done.
But you also happen to do a project called Slug Bug, right?
Yes. It's a fake band. It's a simulation constructed on tape at less than real time.
I have no idea what any of that means. So I take it that might mean something like you repair audio and you're in a band and you record things.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Are you in New York right now?
I am. I'm in Ridgewood, Queens.
Oh, cool. When did you move?
I moved up here in June of 2018. I don't know. Austin was a real good, comfortable place to be for a long time, but I felt like things were like as far as I was going to get there in terms of running around doing different things that might advance one's career. But I'm still friendly with everybody there. I think there wasn't some big altercation. I had to leave or something. Yeah, right.
Well, let's bring up my next guest.
Oh, okay, great. All right, get some like some point counterpoint going on here.
So I feel like I met you because you repaired my Prophet 600.
Yeah. That was the cat pee one, right?
No, but you taught. Wait, was it a cat pee one? I don't fucking remember. But
around that time,
oh my god, the cat pee one. Oh my god, it was the cat pee one. It was a cat pee one. My cat peed on my
I don't care. I have a cat.
Oh my god, it's all coming back to me now. This is so embarrassing. But like, you like hosed that down, and I was like shocked that you hosed it down. I was like, you can seriously host the innards of a synth. Oh my god, I don't think that was mine. I don't know. I can't remember.
Don't worry about it. This was like 12 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It's not.
So your band is called Slug Bug. I mean, I just remember I definitely have seen you driving around town in Austin in your Volkswagen. So
yeah.
Tell me about the name.
Well, I always had an unreasonable fascination with that car. That old air-cooled Volkswagen Bug.
Do you still have it?
No, unfortunately, right before I left, that got wrecked. Somebody blew a stop sign and I T-boned him and thought I was going to die because flimsy, you know, it's like have any crash
protection
at all. No, I did not.
Oh, thank God.
In fact, their car looked way worse than mine. And that was like, I walked away from that accident and I'm like, okay, that's the end of my driving career. That Volkswagen Bug was going to be my first and last car. It was.
Holy shit. So yeah. What? So, okay. All right. I want to know how you got that car, maintained that car. How did you learn how to fix that car?
So my history with the Volkswagen, the air-cooled Volkswagen, living in my parents' house, 6 or 7 years old, the neighbors, one appeared in their backyard, and it was their kid who was going to college in New York or something, and this it was kind of a chopped up one. It was a Baja Bug. You ever see those?
I sure have.
For clearance, when it's used as a dune buggy or something, the front fenders are chopped and the back is usually too, and sometimes the engine is kind of exposed. But anyway, there's one of these cars that showed up I don't know, probably didn't run or anything. I didn't ever see it go. And, climb through a hole in the fence to mess around their backyard and, sit inside this car and this is amazing. There was no question in my mind that that was it. That was the car. And then, my dad's like, oh yeah, I had two of those in the 70s. That was back when just about everybody that had a car probably knew how to wrench on something, right? You had to.
Yeah.
So he kind of knew, he knew how to keep them running to an extent. So when it was time, when I was going to start driving, picked up one of those things and all right, it's like a father son thing. Let's get it to work good. And then I'll drive it to high school.
So, but you're not from Austin originally, right? You're from Waco?
I'm from Waco, Texas, exactly halfway between Dallas and Austin. Yeah.
What's Waco like?
It's very, very boring. You have to invent your own fun if you don't want to go crazy. Those people everybody hears about.
Which people are those?
Their claim to fame, Koresh and all that. I guess they were inventing their own fun in some way, but it ended very badly for them.
Did you ever meet any of those people while you lived there? I guess they're all dead, but...
No, well, yeah, that was happened when I was about 4 years old.
Oh, okay.
So once in a while you'd hear something way later, but I wasn't aware of any of that. The main memory from 1993 I have is going to the zoo for the first time.
What do you remember about it?
It's one of those erased places where you can't find a photograph of it. That kind of stuff's interesting, the mall that was preserved from the 60s there that was torn down in the late 90s, and you can find one image of what it looked like online somewhere, because no one documented, no one uploaded anything about Waco, Texas.
Yeah.
For the most part. That's a digression, I guess. maybe that features into my music a little bit, not nostalgia really, but a confused, misplaced remembrance of things that aren't anymore.
When did you get into music? Were you a musical kid?
So my mom has taught music theory at the college there at Baylor University for as long as I've been alive. So there was always a lot of classical music around. My dad liked to play the Eagles and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and all of this dad stuff that, you know, I think it's pretty good stuff. I'm envious of what type of music our dads had that was just regular music. It's pretty phenomenal stuff, I think.
Well, we still have that music.
You know, Steely Dan. Yeah, but who's Steely Dan now?
I'm Steely Dan now.
Oh, that'd be great. Yes.
So your mom played music. Were you like trained on the piano from day one?
No, I completely resisted that. I said, you know, this is terrible. I don't want to play any scales. I don't want to play hot cross buns. I'm not having any of this. I want to play Nintendo. So I guess I had the advantage of like I can't remember a time when I didn't know what a seventh chord was, for instance, but I didn't think I was interested in doing that and in constructing anything myself or, you know, playing anybody else's stuff really until sometime when I was a teenager. They wanted me to do something like extracurricular that's like, this kid can't just like play Nintendo and take fax machines apart.
Were you always into electronics? I mean, how did you get into that?
Yeah, I think so. Since like, you know, before I acquired any language, I guess, there was a story they told about, you know, me being like two or something and running around and pointing at a thermostat or something going, thermostat, you know, identifying, and then, you know, anything that rotated under its own power, right? My toddler self was fascinated by this, you know, the ceiling fan. Then I saw a record changer, you know, and then at some point I saw a tape recorder. At some point I saw like a reel-to-reel tape recorder. That was really mind-blowing. You know, you think about a rotating object, it's it really sets your imagination going. The possibilities are endless. You know, it's not like it's going in a line. It doesn't have to stop.
Were you allowed to like mess with it?
Yes, to their great credit. My folks, I think they got me my own, but at some point, you know, after like 4 years old, it's like, yeah, let him use the fancy turntable. Like if fix it, if it breaks or something.
Oh, wow. That's yeah. So cool.
I thought it was pretty cool. You know, I'm sure my folks were like, hey, there's this kooky kid that can't get enough of electronics. eventually the neighbors were dropping off broken phones and fax machines. And my dad would be like, okay, you know, cut the power cord off. So can't plug it in. You know, you're not going to shock yourself and have at it. So, you know, I had my number one and number two Phillips screwdrivers and I would explore this inner universe of taking discarded appliances apart. Eventually, way later, figured out how to make it work again.
And how did you figure out how to make it work? Like, did you have somebody that was your mentor?
There was a friend of my folks, a guy called Tom Haddad. I think he's employed by the museum at that Baylor University. Mm-hmm. And we'd hang out and yeah, he'd show me some things about like, you know, I'd have some Casio keyboard that was just my favorite one that had this one particular sound that like, I want this one. I'm not satisfied with any of the digital sampling ones. I want this one that sounds like a weird, you know, I knew it sounded like somewhere between an analog synth and something a little fancier. But anyway, I would be just like, heartbroken when these things would die, you know, like I can't ever get another one of these.
Yeah.
Like this is like slightly before eBay, I guess, right? And so Tom would be like, yeah, see what we can do. And it's inevitably something really easy, like you know, it got plugged into the wrong AC adapter, so yeah, a polarity protection diode blew or some current limiting resistor blew or something, just something happened that's like on the front end of that power circuit that you can fix. So yeah, like Tom would show me that, and then eventually I'd kind of tried that stuff myself, like maybe when I was about 12 or something. I had an Atari, the real blocky 2600 one.
Yeah.
And that quit, and eventually it was like the same thing, you know, it's like, oh, it's the power inlet, you know, it's got a cold solder joint on it, I think I can do this. And then like just like late late one night when I'm starting to stay up till 2 a.m. all the time at 12 years old, I get this thing to work. And just, oh my God. You know,
how did it feel to make something work for the first time? Like repair it?
Oh, you know, godlike.
Dude, I know, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, God. I can't believe it. What, just wanted to try it again. It's the best feeling in the world.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. And you know what the worst feeling in the world is?
When
is
you can't. Like
when you fucking can't.
Yeah. All this stuff was made by humans and can be understood by humans unless it involves a lot of software and custom chips and embedded operating systems. And then you're very much at the mercy of whoever programmed it from, source code you're never going to see.
Do you use a lot of soft synths, or are you like strictly analog?
I'm not, you might think I'm a zealot about it, or it has to be one way or the other, but I don't really care that much anymore. I did use on the last record I made, it's like, there's like one or two things on there that came from a soft synth, or there was one where I was really into this like general MIDI slap bass sound and the xylophone, and I just had to have these like goofy MIDI sounds. So that came off a soft synth. And then there's some other thing that did, it was like from a demo that I recorded on the computer that did. But largely it was like, like stuff played by hand on Arp Odyssey on the tape machine. And it sounds more personable to me played by hand with little goofs in it. And I definitely don't really like to have a lot of sequence stuff.
Really? Your stuff is so complex. It like shocks me that it's live.
Almost no sequencing.
Shut the fuck up. That is bonkers.
It is written and arranged. I'll make like a prototype using like scratch drum samples and general MIDI stuff. It's kind of like, I don't really care how it sounds. In fact, better that it sounds not the way I want it to sound, because then when I do it with the real stuff, just sounds great. If you play one note, then it'll probably sound mind blowing. Yeah. But in making these demos, and at some point I always use like an old version of Cakewalk, and then I started using Reaper.
Oh my God, Cakewalk, that's so
crazy
old. That was like, I have this like vision of like going to my boyfriend's house when I was like in junior high, by the way. Sorry mom, I was not supposed to have a boyfriend in junior high, but I did. And he had Cakewalk, and
it'd be about that time, right? Like
I don't know,
this software, I think I still use it. It still runs, right? At some point, side note, like I was talking to John Mouse about this, and he was like, I use the same one. I think it's like Cakewalk Pro Audio 9 or something like that. And it's some version where they had just added audio, it's like barely a DAW.
Yeah.
But it, still works, and still that works well for making demos of music arrangements and stuff if you're going to like re-implement them later.
Yeah. You were in John Mouse's band for a while, weren't you?
No, I was not. No.
Oh, what? I thought that you had joined his band.
No, that was Ariel Pink.
Oh, okay. What was that like?
Yeah, this was going very smoothly until now. Just all that stuff happened earlier this year.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, well, fuck,
Are you still playing in his band?
No. Yeah. Well, he hasn't had any gigs. He went and got canceled. You know how it went.
Yeah, I do know how it went.
I just think it was a totally self-destructive, just theatrically stupid move that I just don't respect at all.
Yeah.
Even though I was around them a lot, it was just like from the start, it was clearly like, I don't want to get too involved with this. I'm just here to do a job.
Well, how did you get involved? And what was your relationship with Ariel before you joined the band?
So, yeah, I didn't personally know him at all. I mean, like,
when you got involved,
knew a bunch of people that had run into him, and most of them didn't have anything that pleasant to say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just kind of like at this point where I got asked to do this, like I was very tired of where I was at. I was in that old velvet rut they speak of where it's a little too nice to leave.
In Austin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I've been there myself.
Work was getting sort of, it was getting sort of crushing to the point where, like, you know, a room full of synthesizers that had been in a studio fire had just showed up, and like me and the other guy were tacitly expected to like restore all these things. And I'm just like, this is, you know, this is a massacre. This is impossible. I'm getting out of here. Like I don't care how much a memory Moog is worth. I don't care how much a CS80 is worth. It's like meaningless to me now. And the same with like anything I was doing with regards to recording or playing shows. I've just like had a vision of myself still recording garage bands when I was 40 or something, and like I've got to go do something else.
So yeah. So the opportunity crossed your path. Like, how did you make that connection?
I went to a show in like November 17, and you know, I was talking to him after the thing. Well, I didn't actually, my partner at the time introduced myself. I was probably too shy to ever attempt such a thing. And then he was like, "Oh yeah, you're that guy. You want to go play keyboards in Europe in the fall?" And I'm like, "What? Oh my god."
Yeah.
This is happening?
Yeah.
I mean, regardless, you know, I still think this guy's a punk ass for making his album sound so bad. But
how so?
It's you know, it's just clipped all to hell, and then it's all mid-range and treble. There's no good bass or punchy stuff on there. It's just like Pom Pom's a masterpiece and it sounds awful. I was like, okay, you know, I think I had some reservations about doing it, but I just decided on balance, like, you know, if it's gonna happen for me, this is how it happens.
So did you expect what happened with their with him and John Mouse's participation on January 6th, like, to happen? Was that any of that surprising to you?
No, I didn't expect that at all. Now, since the pandemic started, I think everybody was holed up. Everybody basically went nuts. I guess he was, you know, posting some kind of alt-right stuff on his Twitter, maybe in like August 2020 or something, that I mean, you know, I guess he can say whatever he wants. It's very sad that he's been reduced to, you know, being a living music legend to an edgy dad on Twitter. But yeah, he was saying some of that plandemic kind of shit around then. And I don't use Twitter, so I didn't see any of it. So yeah, it was a surprise.
Yeah.
But it was also kind of, it also like, yeah, that's pretty on brand for them to, you know, that's partially how, well, not Mouse, but that's how he stays in the press, I guess, is just does something ridiculous every once in a while. And
yeah, edgelord.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't have any use for that.
I don't know. Like, is he just like flailing because he's become less relevant as time goes on, and this is his way of, you know, being relevant?
Maybe, but at the same time, like, while, you know, in the personal conversations I had with him, like, when we were doing the thing and on tour, it sounded like, you know, it sounded like he wanted to retire from performing music and not record, and
well,
you know,
he did
he's talking about, like, you know, what I really want is to have a family and just have this you know, only do that if I want to. And you know, I'm thinking like, well, you know, you can do that without just blowing up your whole legacy. I don't get it. It's sad.
Well, I mean, I think we have to maybe just like take a step back and take him for his word. Like,
yeah,
you know, he's said a lot of things. He went on fucking Tucker Carlson. Like, I'm pretty sure he genuinely means the things that he's put effort into espousing. So I don't really,
I think he believed it to, you know, just because he has to be edgy, and then crossed over to really buying it. That's easy to do, you know?
How did that feel to you when all that news broke?
It felt kind of, I put a whole lot of effort into working on, you know, working with him on stuff for 2.5 years. And just, I mean, he must have known that, yeah, your label's going to drop you. And, you know, just like, it's going to go to shit if you do that. Any of that stuff.
There's this thing where, as like leftist Texans, we encounter a lot of people every fucking day of our lives in various situations that think completely differently than us.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways, yeah. I think that we've been conditioned to, as Texans, to be a bit more accepting of terrible viewpoints than maybe we should. And like the Trump election, you know, in my opinion, one of the positive things that happened after Trump got elected was that there was an amplification of younger progressive.
There was a lot of stuff has come to a head very quickly. And, you know, that makes Ariel's Twitter antics like all the more tone deaf, right? It's just like, this is not the time, dude. It wasn't ever the time, but especially not now.
Exactly. Like, you know, the internet basically allowed these communities to grow and organize, and it created an environment where people are held accountable for their actions now. Basically, I guess what I'm getting at is like, how do you feel about the internet delivering that swift, broad accountability since Trump?
It's good that people are angry about the right things and are not having it anymore. You know, you want to make an omelet, you got to break some heads.
Yeah. I mean, I can say this to you is like, from knowing you, like, you really don't deserve to be sucked into this traumatizing thing. You were talking about Cakewalk. Sorry to like throw a wrench into the conversation.
Yeah, before the Ariel Pink stuff came up. So Cakewalk Pro Audio version 9, which has like limited. I didn't record any audio into the computer doing demos. Like, I would substitute what the vocal line was going to be like with, like, you know, like the funniest cheesy tenor sax sound and stuff. Basically, you know, seeing what I could get away with. And then sometimes I'd start overdubbing on top of a copy of the demo, like on my 16 track or on the 8 track, and just eventually like remake, you know, using the timing from that, remake all the elements of the thing like it was, you know, with a little human slop in them. and there's a whole lot of tight punch-ins and edits and stuff. And sometimes I have to run the machine at a slower speed than normal to like be able to play it as precisely as I want to hear it.
Okay. Cause like your shit is so complicated, and like for someone who claims not to have any formal training, I can't conceive of that being actually true from hearing your track. So that makes a lot of sense.
What you mean in terms of like instrumental ability or?
Well, I mean, all of the above, like I mean, you said that you don't use MIDI, and your parts are extremely shredding, complicated, like Baroque sort of classical sounding.
A lot of it is something like if you shot a movie, it's like pixelation, right? In the cinematic sense, it's like if you shot a movie at 18 frames a second instead of 24 and then played it at 24, you know, like an old Charlie Chaplin or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just a bit sped up, it's just a bit faster and more precise than is possible by normal neurons and motor control.
So
all of the drums, for instance, that I played, like I can sort of get the drums I hear in my head out through my hands and hit the boxes and put the microphones up, but it's all done, you know, with the machine running like minus 12% or something, which also makes the tone better. It makes it less flappy and more, you know, a tighter tone out of those drums, which has been like, you know, my major obsession for the last 5 years or something. It's just like
tight
a really,
drums.
Really good tight kick and snare drum with no reverb.
No verb. Like wow.
No. As little as possible. Yeah, I use it a bit, but it's like I'll never. There'll never be anything drenched on a Slugbug album.
Oh, what about your vocals?
It's usually some form of echo or like harmonizer feeding back with the pitch changing on each feedback and
you're not scared of processing.
No, not a lot.
You just want like clarity.
I want clarity. I don't like effects that
Is this like a subtle way of telling me you don't like my fucking music?
No, not at all. That's not what I'm saying at all.
I'm cutting that out. I don't know. Everybody is like over reverb. I'm over reverb even. I've worked with the same producer for like years and years, and he did this thing to my vocals. Like, it's just like this like chorus thing that I don't know. Yeah. A younger version of me would have been like, like so horrified, but it's like turned out really nice. So that's good.
That's a tricky chorus on vocals is almost like, that's such a signifier of, and like, what kind of chorus is a real shiny chorus or is it just real sloppy? Or I do that a lot. Like the last record I did, I mean, I guess it's less chorus than it would be called ADT a long time ago.
What's ADT?
Artificial double tracking.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's the same thing. It's just like you have a delay that's not quite in time with the original.
That's something that I love to hear is like, and the natural chorus on like double tracked vocals is just so nice and tight.
Oh yeah.
Like,
the third obsession is double tracking stuff instead of like using an effect on it. And I guess that was kind of around the time whenever I first heard like Here Come the Warm Jets and Taking Tiger Mountain, the Eno records, which was surprisingly late. Like I was just so impressed. He doesn't have a great singing voice by any conventional standard, but what he does with it double tracking is incredible. I know he's doing it on purpose and he'll double track himself where he's singing, a quarter tone sharp or something on the double. And the sound just has this pull and this contour to it. And it's just totally dry and totally like reedy and thin. And the only thing that's happening to it is that, that natural chorus. So that also became a sonic obsession where it's like, I'm going to make this like paper thin, uncomfortably dry record that just doesn't hide anything.
Who are some of your biggest influences?
I'd say at the first thing that really knocked my socks off, and I guess it's kind of like quotidian, is was the Beatles. And then I found out about like their relationship with George Martin. I was like, oh, he's kind of the technical guy that makes it all.
What? Game of Thrones? George R. R.
George Martin? George Martin, the Beatles producer. George, no initials.
Sorry. Okay, continue.
Nobody knows what Beatles Martin middle initials were. I have this memory of like listening to like the beginning of like Sergeant Pepper, and then you hear some like applause and like, wait, they're not actually doing this. This isn't a concert. It's like, oh, it's a concert. No, it's not. They couldn't do all this in a concert and change this many sounds and have it this clean. Mm-hmm. I just really wanted to find out as much as I could about that. And luckily there's a lot written about it.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Not enough about almost any other band that I'd like to know about, but definitely you can find out, what kind of socks the Beatles wore or, what they had for breakfast on some day in 1968.
How does that tie into like how you got into synthesizers? Like, was there a specific band or musician that kind of influenced you in that direction?
Around that time when I was first kind of forming opinions and preferences on music, I didn't think I liked synthesizers like at all.
Really?
Because what I had been exposed to was stuff like, there were some synthesizers around, like I'd go to my mom's office and there'd be Pedagogy Labs, and they'd have like a bunch of Kawai K somethings or something like a Korg M1 but worse, and just all this stuff that made this like the sound that people are getting into now, I guess, right? Finally.
What does that mean? Like, what's the sound?
Like the sound of like a Roland D50 or you know, these sort of halfway sample based low res digital things.
Yeah.
And I guess there's nothing wrong with that, but what was wrong with that to my mind was, like, you know, you'd press one key on that thing and it just sounded like a million things happening at once, and it's, you know, it's too rich and it's too shiny.
Yeah.
Furthermore, nobody edited these presets, much less designed their own. I'm talking about the DX7 thing, you know, in the history of, like, design, use, implementation of synthesizers. Mm-hmm. Everything mostly before the Yamaha DX7 came out had a bunch of knobs on the front, and they had really only just had the ability to, like, store presets. The first one that did that really was, like, the Prophet 5, like a few years before, you know, like 1978 or something. So if somebody was going to play synthesizer in a band or on a record, they would, like, necessarily have to be designing their own sound completely. And granted, these things were a little bit limited in what they could do. Mm-hmm. But it was always, it always seemed like in the synthesizer denoted a spirit of experimentation, and, you know, something weird is going to happen as a result of the synthesizer being a thing in the band. At some point I heard Switched on Bach.
Oh God.
Like on headphones. And that really just changed everything. It changed everything I thought about synthesizer, right? Because it doesn't contain, like, any simulation of a real sound. Like, it's all purely imaginative. And and then you get the early digital stuff, like the DX7 comes out, and what starts happening is, well, for one, probably a lot of people that would have programmed it were dissuaded from doing this because the interface is like a little 2x16 LCD and a bunch of buttons. You have to, you know, go in multiple layers of menus and stuff to then interact with these parameters that you have to understand a bunch of math, basically, to get it to, you know, intuitively do anything.
Yeah.
So you end up with, like, the same slap bass sound and the same electric piano sound and the same harmonica sound on, like, every mid 80s pop record. And that just sounds like, it sounds so soul crushing to me. It just sounds like this, like, fascist sound to have every synthesizer sound the same. And fascist, that was still going.
Well, I mean, I find that an interesting comment, fascist sound, because there's definitely, yeah, like, I don't know if you've paid attention to what's been happening in the synth community the last couple of years, but
try to avoid it.
But, like, you know, synth music has been co-opted, and there's, like, genres called fashwave now, you know.
Yeah, they're, like, the whole synthwave thing, which always sounded, you know, insanely derivative and unoriginal to me anyway, was, yeah, there's, like, oh, of course we got some, like, alt-right people into this, right? Because
why?
Yeah, it sounds like worshiping a supposedly better past while injecting little or no originality or weirdness, you know.
Exactly.
That's exactly what they do, isn't it?
It is exactly what they do. Yeah. They weaponize nostalgia.
So it makes sense. That they love the Lindrum and love the DX7 slap bass and stuff. Like, yeah, I was right.
Well, okay. So as far as, like, originality and weirdness, how do you get there? Like, how do you cultivate that in your music?
That happens by itself. I mean, specifically the reason I do it is in order to, you know, I'm, like, amuse myself with these decisions I can't rationally explain, you know, why it had to be that way.
One of my favorite songs of yours is The Weird Life. I'm belly for the problem zone. Shut up. Try to get a word in advice. Try to get a word in advice. Like, there's something so pure. I mean, I'm just, like, an outsider kind of, like, looking in. But, like, when I listen to that song, I imagine this, like, kid in Waco, Texas, just, like, trying to break the fuck out.
That's the most on-the-nose thing I've ever written, probably. And it was deeply felt And Waco, Texas is the most, it's the most Southern Baptist, you know, ultra right place on earth. And you, you know, you just want to, you just want to scream, you know, or get out.
Yeah. Yeah. How was it like growing up there, being who you are?
Well, I really feel like, my parents are just wonderful. I think in comparison to, I didn't think that at the time, and took them for granted for sure when I lived with them. But you know, they got their heads screwed on straight. They're
yeah.
They don't. Well, it sounds like they never really said I had to be one way or the other. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even the fact that you know you talked about that they let you take apart things, like that is so nurturing and conscious of what you needed to do as a child.
Yeah, it was what I needed to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And how do you feel like they facilitated these things for you? Like, what are some of the other ways?
My music interest like took a big back burner then to like my video and film. Like I thought I was going to make, films or movies or cartoons or something, someday. So I was constantly like, they had like a, you know, VHS, camcorder that was used to take movies of me and my sister as babies. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, you know, these things always kind of fall out of use. And so, you know, they just let us mess with it, you know, like, wow. Those were really expensive too. You know, I don't remember that probably cost $1,000 back then, right? Something around that. So, you know, we just have the greatest time like making our own fake videotape movies.
Do you collaborate a lot with your sister?
Back then I did. She always had an idea of a story and I never did, which is, you know, that's the reason why I'm, you know, a fake musician instead of any kind of filmmaker.
Fake musician? You're a complete shredder. Like, I don't know what you're talking about.
It's not my job to say I'm a real musician.
Oh, I'll say it.
That remains to be seen by me.
What is it that Andy Warhol said one time? It's like, don't think about making art, just get it done and let everybody else decide if it's good or bad. And then while they're deciding, just make more art.
There you go. He was a smart guy, I think.
He was all right.
I've never heard that, but yeah, it makes total sense.
So, but you do kind of like make these films, like your music videos are amazing. In that they're so weird and random and like,
yeah,
you really do distill the character of your songs and your videos. Can you tell me kind of about your process with that?
You know, it certainly starts, you film a bunch of stuff, you get it on a timeline, you start, moving stuff around until it, you know, eventually, oh, I can assemble some kind of meta narrative out of these images in a row. And maybe that's overthinking, like maybe it only has meaning because I, you know, want it to or something.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, to make a compelling music video, you only have to like make the viewer think that it means something. that probably goes for a lot of other types of filmmaking as well.
So you've been fooling me this whole time, that's what you're getting at?
I don't know. isn't that what isn't that what electronic media creation is, or
what a lie.
None of this is somebody like playing the violin in real time or something. It's all carefully constructed.
Yeah. I guess we are huge liars in that way.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's a lie is way more interesting than the truth. I don't believe that authenticity applies to music. I really am not interested in that. I take kind of a conservative approach to assembling my, I won't pitch correct vocals or something, right?
What? But why?
Really, I don't like the way it sounds. I'd rather the old school way of doing that was to double track it and mm-hmm. make the pitch less accurate. It was like, oh, if you got two pitches that are almost the right pitch,
you got a sexy chorus.
Wouldn't that sound way better than like a human voice that is just singing perfect. Like exactly, you know, 440.000 hertz, and that makes my hair stand on end. That sound.
You're gonna hate everything I've been working on. I recently got Melodyne, and like,
yeah,
it just like as a vocalist, so much creative block has arisen from not wanting to track vocals because it feels right. so nasty yeah. to hear my own
it's a
voice.
It's a big commitment. It's like tracking vocals or appearing on camera or something. It's like, God, have I really got to do this? I got around worrying about sounding bad on microphone by going like, you know, okay, I'm just gonna like put as much energy as possible into this performance and just keep it from distorting. And then like, well, if the pitch is funny, then at least they'll go like wow, he's really singing this stuff, you know.
I want to know about like the most psychic or unexplained or supernatural shit that's ever happened to you.
That's an interesting one for me. I try to figure out everything and rationalize like as much as I can, but I can't figure out like where songs come from and you know, things that just like occur to you. You think like it has to be that way and I'm not going to be satisfied until it's that way. And like, where did that idea come from? Was that like synthesized from other input a long time ago? Or that seems supernatural to me, is like where you know, where creative ideas come from that then like thing, like, you know, something that just like knocks somebody else's socks off.
This whole time I was just pulling them out of my ass. I don't know.
Yeah. And then it's just the person that thought of it. It's like, oh, I don't know. Just some, oh, this old thing, you know, like,
oh, this old thing.
Yeah. So
the ether.
Yeah. That seems kind of, you know, that seems kind of supernatural to me at this point, and also makes me believe, you know, like, well, you know, if they say AI is going to replace all human labor, well, it's not going to replace creativity.
As always, our theme music is by The Synth Freak from Austin, Texas. Subscribe to their YouTube channel at @TheSynthFreak, with the freak spelled F-R-E-Q, just like the show. The rest of this music that you heard in this episode is by none other than Paul Miller of Slugbug. You can check out his website to buy records and just learn more about him at slugbug.sound-club.org. If you have the chance, like, review, rate, and subscribe to our podcast, wherever you do that kind of thing. It's super helpful and we really appreciate it.
I'm turning into a bug. I'm turning into a bug. No. Yes.